Blog Talk Radio.
Simone, as always, as for the past 9 years, leading this show and welcome people to She's Raising Bob Block Talk Radio. On the show 9 years, serving the airways for the past 9 years. West Coast people, it's 10 o'clock there. How are you? East Coast peeps, it's
hey.
1 o'clock and we're hating our West Coast peeps. Right, Cindy? We're hating the people on the West Coast because we're in at least 2 feet of snow. West Coast, let me look at my temps, and they're enjoying 72 degrees as we speak. So, you know what, it is what it is, and we're in New York, and there's a wonderful tapestry that goes along with that. So welcome, people. Thank you for joining us. I'm your humble host, Laurie Towers, and for the people that are just joining us, thank you for coming on board. And the people that have been with me for the past 9 years, thank you so much for always tuning in, whether it's live or in the archives. The ratings are great, and we so appreciate you joining us whenever you can. And one thing that's beautiful about archives is you could listen to us anytime you want, in your car, 2 days from now, 2 weeks from now, 2 years from now. That's the beautiful thing. So if you can't join us live, always know She's Raising the Bob Block Talk Radio. You could go to our archives and listen to us and enjoy with a glass of wine, with a cup of cocoa, whatever you want. I have to say, one of the best things about the show is the fact that I have the best seat in the house, and I'll tell you why. I get to enjoy the glories of my sisters. I get to interview wonderful women every single week. Women who are multifaceted, women who are just talented, women who are trailblazers. You're getting what I'm saying, right? And that is such a buzz for me to just applaud these women, celebrate these women, and get their message out there, because I think the little girls coming up need to see it. And the women who are already coming up need to applaud it and need to say, you know what, everybody's, just because somebody is successful, that does not diminish my own. And I think that what women have to do as a gender is realize that by applauding each other, you know, a rising tide raises all boats. And that's what I love about this show. It's just, I get a buzz from the women I interview every week, and I go out and I use it. And I think that's what everybody should be doing. And you know what? If you aren't of that mindset, maybe you should start thinking in terms of that, because life is a lot easier when you realize, you know, the sun is enough for everybody and not feel threatened by anybody else's success, beauty, whatever. Whatever you're thinking you are not enough of, forget that. Listen to the show and just enjoy the applause that we give our sisters. The woman that's on this week, you know, this woman and I travel in the same circles. We know the same people, and yet we've always missed each other, and we're going to make sure we don't miss each other anymore. Cindy Dawson is one of those multifaceted women that I applaud. Singer, poet, writer, actor, dancer, I'm going to say tree surgeon, but I'm just being fresh, of course not. But she is a woman who pretty much does everything. And in addition to being a business owner, so I welcome Cindy to the show. Cindy, are you there? Cindy, are you there? Oh boy, that was a great. She just texted me that she lost me. Call back, Cindy. And oh my God, it's all white, and she's telling me it's all white noise, and it might just be on her end. Jeez, I hope she heard the introduction that I gave her. You know, I'm going to tell her to call back in. But let me tell you something about this woman. She's a writer, and I've read a lot of her poetry, and it's just absolutely wonderful. And she's also a singer. And what I wanted to talk to her about this today was I want to know her influences, because I'm a singer as well. I sang for a few years, and I wanted to get her influences as far as I'm someone who loves the gritty rock of Ann Wilson and Janis Joplin, and I think she's on the air with us now. But I also enjoy the sterile instrument of Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald. So, Cindy, are you there with us?
I am. Something happened. I don't know if it's the weather, and you just suddenly disappeared.
Thank goodness. I'm back. Did you miss that lovely intro I gave you? Well, you'll hear it later.
Yes, I did, but I'll have to listen later.
You'll listen later. How are you, darling?
I'm good.
Yeah. You know, I want to ask you, because, again, in addition to being a wonderful artist of many layers, you're also a business owner. So how is everything out there with outdoor dining and everything that could have been impacted poorly by this storm?
It's been so bad that we're so used to the bad that we have learned. A crazy thing happens. It's like when you're in the middle of like just this survival mode that you go into, and you just soldier on. I mean, it's almost like, okay, you know, another thing, and you just get out and you do what you have to do. I mean, being that my business is in Hoboken, you know, all you got to do really is get the sidewalk cleared. People that live there don't really drive anyway. They're just going to come out for the excitement of the storm and go anyway. But for restaurants that don't have that kind of setup or not in a city, my heart just bleeds for them, because we've suffered. This industry has suffered so much.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I look at it two different ways. You know, I always preface this by saying I'm very fortunate. You know, I have wine in my bar. I have food in my house. I have heat in my house. And then I have all my animals doing well. Speaking of, that's great. But this is, I always say, I'm among the fortunate. And I think about, I look at Facebook every day and I look at the memories. And I'm sure you do the same thing as performers. And I looked at my Facebook memories today, and if you haven't been to this club, I think you would have loved it, Cafe Bohemia. Kerouac was there.
Oh, yeah.
It was great. Mingus was there. Miles was there. Everybody was there. And we actually had a big opening. My husband is a jazz critic, and he also was curating monthly festivals there. And we did it last year at February 26th. And Puma Pearl, who was a mutual friend of ours, wonderful and brilliant artist and poet, she was there with her band, and they rocked. And she did spoken word. And it was wonderful. And this was all February 26th. And then it all stopped.
Yeah.
And this is just what a lot of people can't grapple with if they haven't been on the stage, that it everything just was stunted.
My last show was on March 6th. And my big birthday party, my big birthday bash that had a lot of, you know, big names coming to play. Plus, you know, it's like the one time where I do let myself drink all night. I don't go on stage drunk ever. anymore, ever.
Yeah.
And but on my birthday bash, I give myself permission to just be as ridiculous as I need to be.
Good for you.
And
good for you.
I was looking forward to that, and then of course, you know, everything hit, and that was my last. So my last show was the 6th, and my last show was with Alan Moore.
Oh wow! And where was this, love? Where was this?
You know, I can't offhand. It was uptown. And it was at a club that we'd never played before. I can't think of the name right now. I had never been there before. I know that you go downstairs and there's this like pretty cool performance space downstairs. So ashamed that I can't think of the name, but it'll come to me. I went on before Alan, so I didn't use the microphone after him, but you know, it's just I've played so many times with Alan. I've done 80% of my shows with Alan, so it was so taken for granted. I mean, it's like okay, I go on, and when I'm done, then Alan goes on, and we said hello. I didn't really know at that point about this virus. I just wasn't really all that aware of.
I know.
Really entailed outside of China, and when I said goodbye to Alan, I could not have in my mind have imagined a week later he'd be gone.
Oh, God.
Couldn't imagine.
Oh, God.
And that's how that whole pandemic started for me was then I had to cancel the birthday show, which I did, and then got the news of Alan the next day. I just could not, or 2 days later, I couldn't. It's been rough for everybody, but I'm one of these people that likes to see the beauty in all things.
Good.
I've lost customers, lost other friends from this, and some deaths were not related to actually dying from the virus, but were related by proxy, you know, suicides, things like that. And throughout this, and throughout all the months of being closed, thinking I'm losing everything I've ever worked for, just all this stuff, I actually found a lot of really beautiful things. And they say in disasters, you find a lot of beauty. And if you don't, I mean, you've got to find something that keeps you going with your brain intact. Because if you don't, the obvious is a lot of suicides occurred. And that was not going to be me. You know, I was not going to, I was going to fight tooth and nail to get through this horrible depression that I found myself in with the business. And so one day I literally got up and said, that's it. I'm going out. I'm going to start walking around the neighborhood and my neighbors and I found ways to pull our, like it was still warm out. So we found, you know, ways to go in the street with our dinners and lounge chairs and have dinner together, even though everybody was in their own driveway. And then we started pulling the chairs up a little closer, but we were still safely spaced at the time. And we just kept going. Yeah. That's what you do. You soldier on. You just keep going.
And, you know, Bach actually wrote some wonderful pieces during the plague. And one of them, oddly enough, was entitled, I Have No Health in My Body. And people always say, well, you're kidding. No, I'm not. That's a piece that he wrote. And this is what I always say. In the arts, there is inspiration, whether it's born of anger, sadness. People can actually translate that into whatever their form of art is. It could be painting. It could be writing. It could be singing, whatever it is. But if we could translate that into something that's healing, I think that we're saved.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the inevitable is going to happen around you when you're talking about being and living through a pandemic. The inevitable is just going to happen, and I don't think that there was much more that we could do to stop it outside of what we were doing. So you have to continue to create, make music. Wasn't as easy for some as others, but people found really cool creative ways to do that. We managed to start an album right before the pandemic hit last February, but we continued to write and rehearse and get the songs ready, which we're going to be doing this month. We're going to finish them up this month.
Oh, nice.
That's what we chose to do. We chose to, I got tested, and I got tested every 3 weeks,
good.
And the band continues to work together.
Mm-hmm.
Henry, who's my co-founder and co-writer with the band, we never stopped getting together. Initially, we would go on the boardwalk where he lives. He lives in Perth Amboy by the water. And we'd go on the boardwalk with our papers blowing all over the place.
Oh.
And masks and sunglasses.
I love it.
We couldn't see how we were, couldn't hear each other sing. We couldn't see if the other approved of something we came up with. And, I couldn't hear the guitar. And finally, we just said, this is not going to work. If we're going to get together, we just both make sure we're not sick. And he really wasn't seeing anybody at the time. He lives alone. And I was getting tested and pretty much not really seeing anybody except, my household. And we just took the chance and kept on going.
Yeah. You know what's interesting is I had somebody on the show about a couple months ago, and she's a psychologist, and she was even saying that the fact that we didn't know what was going to happen was probably the best thing that could happen to us, because I look at all my Facebook memories and I see the innocent faces that had no idea what was around the bend, no idea. We were thinking when all this first happened, it's going to be 2 weeks. It's going to be 2 months. Broadway will be back in December. The Rockettes will go on stage. That never happened. So the fact that we didn't know that, I think we were living on borrowed hope, and that actually helped us.
Oh, if you would have told me that my bar was going to be closed for 3 months, and then they were going to put it to 25% capacity and close it at 10 p.m. for the rest of the year, I probably would have had a breakdown because I would not have been able to understand how we could have paid our bills.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I know. You know what? I'm always interested in this. How is Murphy? Because I know that Cuomo is getting a lot of backlash for how he's handling this. How do you think Murphy is handling things on your end?
It's a mixed review for me because I understand the shutdowns in the beginning because this was new. We didn't understand it, and we would have shut the bar down even if we weren't made to for the at the beginning, those first few weeks when we didn't know what the heck was going on because we didn't want death on our hands. But once we understood and got a handle on it, and realized that, we could do these things. And it was going to cost a lot of money, but, you put in plexiglass between tables. Everybody has to abide by certain rules. We were okay with that, and a lot of people were not. I have friends that are set, and they were like, you guys should just rebel, open the doors, let anybody come in. But you can't do that because you can lose your license. Mm-hmm. If you lose your license, you'll never open again anywhere. And so and I thought that Murphy was doing the right thing in the beginning. But then when we were supposed to open in 3 days back in May, and he announced 3 days that we were going to open up, and everybody went out and bought their food and their stock and paid for all their electric and, put out all this money that they didn't have because they had been closed for 3 months, but you borrowed it.
Yeah.
And then three days before you're supposed to open, he said, oh, no, I'm closing you all indefinitely. And that was, you had to throw the food out. The beer was no good anymore.
Jesus Christ.
And so that hurt. And that's when I really was angry and went into a very bad depression because I felt like we were being forced to go broke. We were forced to lose things that we worked for.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they allowed the outdoor stuff, Hoboken was so incredible. I have to give props to Hoboken and the mayor there because they allowed us on Saturdays and Sundays to close the street down and set up the entire. They closed the whole street down and let us set up outside.
Oh, how cool is that?
And we actually had a really good summer. Yeah, capacity still was only at a certain percentage. But people came out with their children. We had more dogs than people half the time. We're a dog.
I love that.
And so you had mothers and fathers come out with the kids and the dogs. And, you know, they had their own table. They were apart from everybody else. Masks if you had to go to the bathroom. Nobody was getting sick. So Murphy realized that. And he said, you know, look, until you could prove to me that it's the bars and restaurants that are cases are being traced back to, I'm going to reopen them. And he, to his credit, he did at 25% capacity. But again, it cost everybody a lot of money. We had to get kerosene heaters for the garden, which is very expensive to run. And we had to put up plexiglass, which was, you know, it's got to be custom made and sized. There was a lot of things we had to install, like hand sanitation stations, special cleaning solutions to disinfect. And that we were okay to do that because we were so glad to have money coming back in. It wasn't, it was 25% capacity at 100% rent. But you found yourself in a thing where you could never imagine yourself being grateful for 25% capacity. That's what it drove me to. But I heard that this Friday they're allowing 35% capacity and they're going to take away the 10 p.m. curfew, which is frankly long overdue.
And what they're going to, what is it going to be? 12 p.m. What are they going to do for the curfew?
I'm not sure because I'm only just hearing this today, so it's coming in bits and pieces. Listen, even if they got us up to 12, when we signed our lease, we signed our lease at a 274 person capacity till 3 o'clock in the morning, and you know that's what we agreed on in a contract. So I understand it's a pandemic, but 25% capacity at 10 o'clock at night, you know, that's, people aren't even getting out of work and getting into the bar till 7, 8 at night.
I
can't live on people drinking for 2 hours.
No. I always say, I preface my next statement with I'm glad I'm not in charge of creating the laws that govern this, because I would hurt, I know I would hurt a certain amount of the population, but there's got to be a way to subsidize bars, restaurants. Look, you're taking away their income, pad them in some way, insulate them in some way. There's got to be, because you can't have people, and I have a big theater community. We can't do this and just expect people to just, you know what, I'm going to go on unemployment. You can't do that.
No, they tax you on the unemployment anyway. And, you know, let's face it, if you're a bar staff or restaurant staff, you're not really making a lot of your money in salary. You're making it on tips. And your tips vary. You could have a good week. You could have a bad week. So unemployment is basing it on your money that you put down on the books. And if anybody thinks that people who make tips, you know, have any kind of a steady sort of money to report with their tips, they're crazy. You know, you could have a slow night and make nothing in tips. So what happened was, you know, we got these PPPs, and the PPPs were really to pay staff. So people are saying, oh, well, didn't you get all that money? Didn't you get that grant from the government? First of all, they weren't grants. They were loans. And they were only forgivable if you paid your staff. And the staff was like, we don't want $200 a week from what we made on the books. You know, we can go to unemployment and get the extra $600, and then we're getting $800 a week. And who would turn that down? So the staff was begging us, please, like, you know, we're going to have to quit. Because we can't accept $200 a week. One of my bartenders just had a baby. And there's no way, you know, he could live on $200 a week with a baby. You know, in the beginning, we paid our staff out of our own pockets, thinking that this was going to last about 2-3 weeks. And we took care of everybody for that 2 or 3 weeks. We didn't even pay ourselves because we said, you know, we can handle it for 2 or 3 weeks.
But,
you know, and little did we know. So, you know, the PPPs, you have to pay the staff. There's very little left over to actually cover your costs of running a bar. So that really is for the staff, not for the bar. And people don't realize that.
And that's the thing. People don't realize the enormity and the impact of paying employees. And, again, everything impacts on everything else. And I have an inroad to the theater, and I always say, last year at this time, when I was hearing from my people in the theater saying it's not going to be back until 2021, if that, and I didn't want to hear it. You don't want to hear stuff like that. But I think that was the most accurate barometer that I had, because people were saying 2 weeks, 3 weeks. People that I knew of that were there were probably the most accurate with anything that, as far as numbers. And they're saying it might not even be till the end of 2021. So this is what you have to keep in mind.
Yeah, I even heard 2022, but I am an optimist. I'm an optimist. And you know, with this vaccine and now with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that might get approved any day now.
I know.
I think that, and Biden isn't, you know, actually has a plan, which is, wow, a plan.
I know.
Who thought? So I think that things are going to speed up. And I do believe that the vaccine is going to be, it's going to get better. I don't think it's going to get worse. I think the outlook will be better than we thought.
Of course. And, again, we have different people speaking on different sides, and that's fine. It's great. But if we could agree on one thing, the prior administration did not handle this well, because if they did, we would have all been vaccinated, not by this time, but we would have been in the ripening age of vaccination. This is it. By the time probably August, everybody would have been vaccinated by now.
Well,
and
I don't know about that, though, Lori, because its production has a lot. I mean, you can only produce so much vaccine at a time, but the fact that there's
absolutely
a plan now to actually distribute it and production will increase is really good news.
But if the prior administration actually acknowledged that there was a problem, I think that that would have, and said, you know, again,
true, that,
it
yeah,
was
that's
a blame
a
game.
Yeah,
the blame game is a China. You know what? Forget about who it is. Get a plan in motion. And we didn't. And if we had something in April of last year, everything would be different now.
Yeah. There is a lot of if this only happened, where we'd be today.
Yeah.
And the fact is that we just are where we are today. And, again, me being an optimist, I'm already seeing in New Jersey, I'm like obsessed with those graphs. You could type into Google anything, any state. Like, for example, I'll say New Jersey COVID graph today or Pennsylvania COVID graph today. And you'll come up with a graph. Obsessed with these graphs and watching the numbers. And we have had a pretty steady decline in cases now in New York, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. That is a really good sign. Because more people are out now more than ever. If anything, you just see cases rising and rising and rising. The fact that they're going down in these very populated areas is a really good sign.
And I have to say, my office is right across from Carnegie Hall. And when I take the train into my office, everybody has a mask. So everybody's doing the right thing. And
you
that's
know why
what
New
I think
York is so good, though? New York saw the worst horror show of any of these states because they live right on top of it. You know, I'm in like a suburban area, and we saw nothing here. I mean, it was like life kind of just went on in a way normally here. But my friends in the city were telling me that they had to live with sirens nonstop and watching people being taken out of their buildings.
Yeah.
I think your perspective is a lot different depending on where you live through this.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, it's funny because John and I, my husband and I, were in a restaurant, and it was, oh my God, it had to be, let's see, March 14th of last year. And we're sitting there, and we're having one of our favorite places in Bay Ridge in Brooklyn. And we're sitting there having a good time, and one of our friends keeps texting me saying, "You guys got to get out of there. This is going to be a big thing. You should be wearing masks. This is going." And we were like, oh, you know what, maybe she's not right. Maybe, again, she's just being an overreactionary person. And March 16th, it all happened. And all the restaurants were closed. And we never thought this could happen. And it happened so quickly that we couldn't even hold on to the rope to pull it back. And I think
that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
My daughter wrote me a text. My daughter, Chelsea, is a worrywart. So, like, she's just one of these people that is, like, she unfortunately lost several friends at very young ages. And she became, like, sort of, like death obsessed. Where everything was, concerned her. And so she writes me a text before this thing ever really hit. And she said, my friend's in the Army, and he just told me that they're going to be doing a lockdown in America, and everything is going to be closed, and you don't believe me. And I kept saying, Chelsea, you've got to get your anxiety in check. You really have to get your anxiety in check. And the kid ended up being right. She wasn't exaggerating. And everything that she said was going to happen ended up happening. I couldn't believe it.
Jesus, you know, and we share the same circle. I'm gonna say my last gig was 2/26, and we were in Cafe Bohemia, and we just went on stage, and Sherry Rubel, a shared photographer that we love, showed up for dinner. We had dinner with her, and she was going to shoot the gig, and we were assuming that, you know, the feature gig that we had there was going to be one of many. And the next month was going to be Women's History Month, and I was going to be orchestrating a lot of women there, spoken word and, you know, musicians. And it never happened. And when we were sitting there on West 4th, and it was one of those West Village nights, and I know you know what I'm talking about. You're in the middle of everything, and you're in the middle of magic there.
Yeah.
And we just thought everything was going to go on, and it just didn't after that. And that was, and I look at my Facebook pages, that was it. All the posts from that night were the last things I have as being on stage, and nobody knew it could happen.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. If you're an actor or a performer that does, say, you know, like cafe gigs or, you know, little one woman or one man acts like Tammy Faye does, and that's what you do, and that all stops. Mm-hmm. There is, you're not doing anything. I mean, you might be writing something new for when this is over. I was lucky in that I could still record. I could still rehearse. I could still get together with Henry and Wright. That kept my sanity. You know, that's what kept me going through this whole thing. I could still work at what I do, but if you're an actor and there's no shows to perform in, you've lost who you know yourself to be. That's what you do. And I think for people who, like, for people whose work didn't stop, that, you know, were fortunate to be able to work from home, or continue on their work in, you know, safe settings at their jobs, their lives pretty much didn't come to a standstill. They still had a salary coming in, their benefits.
Yeah.
But people don't understand, actors, they lost their benefits. They lost their income. They lost everything that was their day-to-day life. And it's been a long time. It's been a year.
Oh, yeah. And you forget about the actors that go on their go-sees, but they support themselves as a waiter. That's what they do. And if the restaurants aren't there on Restaurant Row in Manhattan, how you do that? It's just crazy.
Right. You know, I don't know if you know this, but I was an actress for 20 years. And so I always had a bartending job. And the jobs that I worked at were really good about letting me come back in between jobs. So if I had a job, somebody would cover for me. And then when my acting job was over, they always held my job for me. And I was really, really lucky that way. But you always knew you had a job. You always had a means of income coming in when your acting jobs weren't happening. But this time, you're right. They didn't even have their bar or restaurant job to go back to. And then even when the bars opened up again, wasn't enough shifts to, because 25%, you just don't need everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. That's you know, again, it's that trickle-down effect. You think, okay, well, just the theaters are closed. Okay, but what about everything that supports the theaters? The restaurants that you go to before, you know, and I was always the first to say, you know, to go to a Broadway show and go and parking and pre-theater dinner, you're talking about at least an $800 night. So I always said it was not really as fair to people that were of average income. I always said that. But now it's gone. Now it's complete, you know, Theater Row, everything that attaches to it is gone. It's dark.
Do you feel like this is going to be the dawn of a golden age? I mean, I feel like once this pandemic starts inching its way behind us, I feel like this is going to be one of those incredible times in our history where everything just blossoms. You're going to have pop-up clubs. You're going to have more and more young people
are going to
come out with bands, and the music scene is going to explode. I feel, and also what's really wonderful too is radio. This was a great year for my band for radio. We probably got more radio exposure this year than any other year we've been together. And I feel like radio got newfound respect because people were home listening. They really were listening.
Exactly.
And also these online shows, and my example for who did it right, example for who did the best shows is, and I've said this before on other shows, Dina Regine did the best home shows I've seen on the internet. She had the right setting. She had the sound down beautifully. She did it just long enough because attention spans are never good for people when they're on Facebook.
Of course.
So she, you know, they'd be watching her show, then go up to get their notifications, then go back on, then go off again. She had a tip cup, like a virtual tip cup. And she's just one of the most talented people out there. So what she did was the example of, okay, you can actually carry this off. And a lot of people did these shows. Tom Edwards, who we know as Gas Wild, his got better and better. Puma and Joe did theirs from Joe's studio.
Yes,
they were
good
shows.
Yep.
A lot of people really got this down, and it was a godsend to some of us that couldn't get out to the city. I couldn't get out to the city. I could.
Of course.
But
not.
To be honest with you, and I did. Actually, I met Puma for lunch one day, or dinner rather. I met a couple of I met another friend who I can't say because his daughter didn't want him leaving the house. I can't say, but he's somebody well known to all of us. We always meet once a month for dinner, so I kept up those with him.
Nice.
I did get into the city, but I was so broke that for me to just take the turnpike and the tunnel and dinner and parking if I couldn't find parking,
totally get it.
That's a $100 night for me. So I couldn't even get out
easily
there as much as I wanted to. I've been on a budget for the first time since we've owned the bar, you know?
Of course.
I enjoy these online shows. I saw as many as I could. Just thank you to the people and the performers. Henry and I did one to help raise money for a station that was looking to go 24 hours, you know, 24/7. And so we enjoyed doing that. It forced us to create like a sin studio in his unused spare bedroom. And that was something that we should have done a long time ago, but it kind of forced us into getting that done. A lot of good things came out of this pandemic.
Yeah.
And I think that when this is behind us, we are going to be bursting with creativity and art that comes out of this.
Oh, I think it's going to be the roaring 20s. I know that that's going to happen. But the fact that, you know, even if we look at this snowstorm, if this happened last year at this time, now we have 80% of the workforce working from home. This it didn't really impact anybody in a negative way because people were already working from home. So there's a lot of wonderful things that came out of this. However, there's the backside of that, of course.
Well, the backside is that real estate in New York is they're going to find out these big office buildings that are spending, you know, enormous amounts of money to be there are going to find out that they don't need these enormous spaces because half their staff can work from home. Although I got to tell you something, I wouldn't look forward to the commute every day because Henry did that and then decided that it was time to stop. And he'd been doing that for like 30 years. So I think that if it were me, I don't look forward to a commute all the time, but I would want to get out of my house once in a while. I don't know if home is necessarily a good thing for everybody.
No. I agree. I lived upstate in the Hudson Valley for about 5 years, and my office is on 57th Street in Midtown. And I went there at least 3 times a week, and that is what kept me sane. So now if I go into my office twice a week, look, I love my home and I love being able to do things from home, but there really is something about getting off near Carnegie Hall and walking, even if you're not walking on the street with the same amount of people, there's something about being in that infuse of people that are hustling and bustling that really makes a difference mentally for you.
I know. You know, another thing that is worth mentioning is that, that, you know, of course, during a time like this, you know, New York City sometimes will have its problems. It's a city. People start running out of jobs. The homeless population increases and stuff. There was like this gloom and doom from some people online, which I understand. You know, it was sometimes hard to go into the city and see things boarded up or, you know, streets that were empty that used to be hustling and bustling.
Yeah,
but I think New York City is a force. New York City is never going to die. New York City is such a magnetic vortex of energy and creativity. I just don't see that city not coming back and better than ever.
I agree. You know, it might be some time, but like I said, when I walk into my office, I keep, you know, the blinders on. I walk straight into there. You don't look at what's happening around you. You don't look at things that are boarded up. You don't look at, you know, people camped out in front of buildings. You keep walking and paying the rent in that building because eventually that's going to subsidize the city. And that's all we have.
Yeah. And I also know, as sad as it was for people to have lost their stores or, you know, that, of course, such a tragedy. Yeah. I don't even know that you need to say that. But it might also on the end of this, on the other end of this, might be a wonderful opportunity for people that otherwise could not have afforded to open a shop, or maybe that this will be an opportunity for them to do that.
Yeah. Well, just after 9/11, the rents went down for about, I think it was a five-year margin. So maybe that'll happen again. You know, I'm such a big fan of film noir, and I watch all these wonderful things that were filmed in the 50s, and you look at people, and you're watching somebody who had a salary of maybe $15,000 a year being able to do it, have a seven-room apartment someplace in the city on one salary. And that was the Manhattan that was years ago, and it could still be. It doesn't have to be, you know, look, I know the rent I'm paying. It doesn't have to be that. You could have a civil servant living in the city again at one point. We just have to figure out how to do that.
And I think that it will be figured out because, you know, everything is relative to what is around it. So if rents go down, prices of things are going to go down. I mean, it just all sort of, everything sort of balances onto itself at some point.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm so excited about music and art. And I mean, imagine all these artists that were stuck in their house for all these months and just creating these works of art. And there'll be galleries popping up to show these works of art.
I know. These pop-up galleries. I think that's going to be wonderful. How have you been inspired by all of this? Again, you have, again, your lens is a little different because not only are you an artist, you're a businesswoman, so what might, you know, ignite the flame to you as an artist might be doused by brick and mortar overhead of a business. So I'm wondering how you sit in all of this.
I just have such a newfound appreciation for everything. I can't explain it. I feel like I am just grateful and humbled by the threat of having come so close to losing everything. I know that sounds dramatic, but horrendous depression that I would look around this home.
Yeah.
I grew up, I've never had a house before. This is the first house in my family that, I mean,
really?
That, well, out of my siblings and stuff. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, we were near homeless. I mean, my mother found this little apartment for us all to live in. And it's a long story, but I, you know, I just feel so humbled that all this hard work that without any help from anyone that my family has done just to acquire a house. And it's a little house. It's not a big, huge house. It's a little cape that's been expanded and it needed a lot of work. Mm-hmm. It was a real fixer upper. And, you know, we've worked all these years to fix it up. And, you know, the bar, same thing. You know, we barred and begged and whatever we had to do to get the bar and paid people back over the years until it became ours. And, you know, so I know that everything we had, we worked for. And so facing losing that and possibly going back to like a little apartment maybe and which in the New Yorkers will look probably listening going, yeah, right, okay. But, you know, I was okay with that. I was okay with that after. I was like, you know what? As long as I have a roof over my head and I'm safe from the weather and we're not starving, you know, I've been there before. I'm okay. I didn't like the thought of having to start over at this point in life, but it's like those are things and they're nice to have and they're nice to acquire. But if I lost it all and I still was just could keep my family together, good. Yeah. That was a good thing. And so I guess it changed me. It changed me that way. I like that I didn't lose everything, but I also know that now I'm not living being, you know, run by all that. If I lost the bar, if we lost the bar, that was a different kind of fear because that was a dream. It went beyond things. It went beyond the material. That's a dream. That was built on a vision and dreams, and that would have been the scariest thing I think I could have ever gone through. And so there was no choice. We couldn't lose it. We would have done anything and everything we had to keep it. Anything and everything to keep it.
Yeah, I hear you. It's a totally different texture. It really is. And, you know, I'm of the mindset, you know, I always say, how much money do I need? How many houses can I live in at the same time? How many cars can I drive? I'm fine with what I have. You know, it's all material. It really is. I'm not worried about that. But, you know, again, when you have a business, there's a little bit of ego infusion. I know with me, I don't want my brand to die, so I will make sure I fortify it with what it needs to grow. That's just the way any body with a business will look at it. And it's not
wrong.
Yeah,
you know, thing about what happened to us, it was a perfect storm, was that we had a business partner that we spent 3 years paying off. After 20 years, this would have been. I remember New Year's Eve of 2019, going into 2020, and toasting that finally, you know, we might be broke now, but we put our kid through college, and finally there was no more business partner, and it was a partner that was not living here and not involved in the running of the business. The whole running of the business was us, and so I remember thinking, wow, this is finally the year that maybe we could start to pay down the house, you know, maybe we could finally find ourselves like in a bit of a better place without constantly owing to college, owing for this, owing for that. And then this, so people are like, of savings? No, we didn't, because we had a plan, and the plan was to get the bar and have it just be ours finally. And the first plan was get my kid through college without any loans. And we did that.
God bless.
And then the second plan was, okay, pay down the house now. You know, get the bar paid off. That it's just in our name. And then the next step would be the house. And so, no, we did not have any savings. We had very little to fall back on. So we borrowed and we borrowed and we borrowed. And you know what? We have all this money that we have to pay back. And it's a lot. It's a lot of money. But it's just money.
Yeah.
It's beads. It's stones. It's monopoly. It's nothing that should
run your life.
Just money.
That's exactly all it is. Totally get
you borrow,
it. You know, when I have
God,
people...
what are they going to do? Come after you in your grave and say, hey, you owe us this money.
Look, I totally agree. When people say to me, well, what about when you retire? First of all, I'm not going to retire. So I love what I do, so I'll be doing it until I can't breathe anymore. But that's the whole thing. It's just money. It's just money.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, when we bought the bar, it was like we didn't have a penny. I had a brand new baby. And as an American, I said, forget it. There's just no way that we could buy a bar. I've got a brand new baby. We don't have savings. And, you know, Paul being European said, well, there's always a way. And he taught me a big lesson. He taught me a big, big lesson that day that it's just money. You borrow. Whatever you got to do, you take a chance, you take a risk. That's life. That is how you do what you do and help successful people become successful because they don't have all the reasons why they can. They come up with all the reasons how they could.
Yeah.
You know, when I first started the band first started, there was no game plan to record and make albums and be on the radio and do shows. It was just, okay, let's do this fun project. And then it became about, you know, where Henry would say, well, why don't you sing instead of speaking your words? And I'm like, you know, I can't. But then again, another lesson in life. He said, why not? And then it just happened. And so, you know, I think if I had not taken chances in life for everything that I've done, I would have done nothing in life.
So why did you not want to sing? I mean, you did spoken word. Why did you not want to sing? Let's get to that.
I was acting for 20 years, and I was a good dancer.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, I studied at some great acting schools. I had good acting chops, good skills. But every time I go for an audition where you had to sing, I literally could hear Scott, like, laughing and snickering. I never passed singing auditions. And so they sent me to this guy who was supposed to teach anybody. Do you remember Sam Schwat? So he had the slogan on his doorway, I could teach anyone to sing. And so me with my little waitressing tips at the time back then, as a very, very young girl, I went to him and I had maybe two lessons with him. And I remember they were very expensive. They were $100 an hour, which was back then an enormous amount of money. And he said to me after my second time with him, he said, Cindy, he said, I'm going to tell you something because I know that you don't have a lot of money and you're working really hard to come and do this. He said, you will never sing. He goes,
oh, wow.
I want you to save your money. You will never sing. And so when I had decided that day that I would never sing ever, ever again, for anybody, in front of anybody, I never did another audition again where I had to sing. I did music videos, but I never, ever, ever did a musical theater audition after that. And so when Henry's me, why don't you just sing? And I said, I can't sing. And it was. In the beginning, it was a disaster. It was absolute disaster. Yeah. But then I had this epiphany one day that I realized that, I'm not a singer like Broadway or Celine Dion or Adele. And then I just said, you know what? I'm just going to be Cindy. And I write these songs. There isn't a way to sing them because I write them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am just going to do what I do. And it was funny because after that, I started to figure out my voice. I started to come to a place where I realized I was a rock singer. I wasn't a singer for Broadway shows. And the more I got the confidence, the better, I guess, things got.
Yeah, but you know what, I think, because I'm listening to what you're saying, and I look at my husband. My husband's a brilliant percussionist and a drummer, but he can't dance with me. he can't dance with me at all. And I always think it's inhibition. He knows, he could feel the rhythm. He could feel a mambo. He could feel a rumba. He could do all of that. He was trained in that. But it's inhibition. And I think the same thing with singing. It's you have to push past the point where, yeah, look, you're not leveling yourself to a Sarah Vaughan or Ella Fitzgerald. You're not doing that. But I think the fact that there's such deep inhibition, you can't do it.
Yeah, when someone tells you at a very young
age, that's just negative reinforcement is horrible. Yeah.
I know what I used to do sometimes, too, was I would sing really badly to be funny after that. Like, I'd be at a party, mm-hmm. and I'd start singing a song, and I would sing it really bad on purpose just to make mm-hmm. people laugh, because that was my way of not having to even try to be a singer.
Sure. Yeah.
But here I am, the front woman of a band, which is the most – if you would have told me ever
That's
back
great.
Then that one day you're going to be fronting this band singing, I would have told you were out of your mind.
So who was it? Who was it that gave you, and again, the naysayers aside, who was it that made you think, you know what, if they could do it, I could do it? Who was that?
It was a series of things. I mean, like I said, I had mm-hmm. this epiphany that I'll just do my thing and not try to sing, be a singer. And then mm-hmm. I came from a family of women, you know, my mother and three girls, so we all screamed at each other all the time growing up. So screaming was not a problem for me. Being loud was never a problem for me, because we had to, you know, when you had a fight with your sisters, you had to be louder than the other one.
Yeah,
and
so, of course.
Yeah, you also had to pull hair harder than the other one. But I think Henry was pivotal in my confidence. But then also when we went to Pepe Castro produced some of the songs on our vinyl album. And mm-hmm. Pepe kept pushing me. He said, I know you got more in you than that. I know. Let's do another take. And mm-hmm. this time I want you to really go for it. So I have to mm-hmm. give Pepe a lot of credit, too. Pepe really pushed me on Mean Girls. We have the song called Mean Girls. That I think that was the turning point for me, is when we recorded Mean Girls. After that, it was all up to me. After that, I knew that I could take it further.
That's you know, again, that's wonderful, because, again, I don't want to be gender specific, but I'm going to. Women are beaten down to a point. When men are beaten down, they kind of know they could overpass that. But when women are beaten down, they kind of become numb to everything and they don't have a voice. The fact that you had people saying you can't, don't bother, and you still pursued. I think I always think of the phrase, "Still she persisted." I think that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, that is, and I think I lived that philosophy. I also grew up with a father that told me I would never amount to anything, and I'd be a failure my whole life. And so, you know, there's a part of me that is, I'll show you. And I think that is a very, if people were ever to say, how do you describe yourself, that probably would be pivotal in describing who I am. I mean, I don't compete with other people. I don't compete with other mm-hmm. women in particular, but I do compete with myself. And I have a very strong competitive streak in myself, with myself. I was a gymnast pretty much all my youth. And so I was extremely competitive with myself and beating my prior scores and things like that. And then I was told I would never be a good dancer because I was the complete wrong body type. And I ended up being a dancer, I taught dance and I did music videos. So that was another thing where I showed people, like, I can do this, and showed myself, rather, that I could do this. And probably a little bit in me wanted to show others as well. But the same thing with the band. I mean, I lost friends when this band started. I lost friends that said, I can't believe at this point in your life, you're a mother, blah, blah, blah. You know, you have a daughter and you're going to be in a rock and roll band, which they don't understand. I always was. I was with the poetry. I always was in a rock and roll band. I just spoke. I didn't sing.
This was women that you lost, right? Is with the women friends?
Yes. They could not believe. I mean, our daughters would be in, like, you know, groups together that we would, you know, class stuff together. You know, I'd be volunteering at the school. And and they just thought, okay, I should not be so selfish and have a life. Like, I raised my daughter for 12 years, and now I wanted to go back to performing because that's what I was before she was born. And I think the best example that I've ever given my daughter was to show her that, first of all, you can pursue dreams at any point in your life, at any age in your life, you can pursue dreams, and that you should always have your passion, always, and you should always follow your passion.
Amen.
It doesn't mean you neglect the people in your life. You know, what's the point of just living your life to make sure everybody else's life is going in a good direction when you're not the example?
Yeah. You know, this is my philosophy again, you know, and when people say, well, you're a feminist, I'm not a feminist, I always think, a quote by Deborah Harry, if you're a woman, how could you not be a feminist? But that's aside. But I always think that even if I don't agree with my sisters, whatever they want to do, you know, I have some friends that say, well, you know what, all I wanted to do was be a mother and a wife. And as much as I can't embrace that, I don't get why, I'm going to support their right to want to do that.
But that is a choice.
Absolutely fine. Yeah, it's a choice. It's not my choice, but I'm not going to tell you can't have your choice. But when women just say, well, you know what, you shouldn't do this because of your age or because of this, because you're a mother, it's just wrong. And I think it's self-hating. I think that's really what it's born of.
I think it's fear, and I think it's fear that if you start doing this and then they don't, they'll be left behind somehow. You know, I worked really hard since I'm 13 years old. I was living on my own from the time I was 16. I was renting a space in my friend's mother's basement, and I had to work every weekend to pay her rent and go to school. So I've always worked, and so there was a point when I had my daughter, I was still bartending. Right up to a week before I had her, I bartended. Mm-hmm. And then I went back 6 weeks later, and I continued to work while I was raising her. And then I had this opportunity. Yeah. When the bar started doing well, I had an opportunity to stop working for a while. I was doing real estate for a while, but you know, as well. But I actually said, you know what? I really want to be part of her life during school. I want to be able to be like a class mom and participate in things. And that was great for 12 years. I worked part-time, but that was really good for 12 years. I could take care of my home, which I never really had a real home before. And and so at some point when she turned 12, I said, okay, you know what? She's in the junior high school now, and they don't need the mothers there. So now it's time for me to start thinking about what am I going to do with the rest of my life? Because
amen.
Yeah, and so – I think I scared a lot of the women that didn't ask themselves that question. I mean, if all you want to do is stay home and raise your children, that's a job. And that's a job that's harder than most jobs because I've done both.
Absolutely.
You know, that's part of being a feminist is to have that choice that even if what you want to do is spend your time, you know, on your home and your children, that's fine. That's a job and that's an important job. But I certainly would never stop being friends with somebody because of their choice of what they decided to do.
Never.
I would support that choice.
Absolutely. And, you know, I have a sister-in-law that I had the same conversation with 20 years ago. Where are you going to be once your children are out of the house and you're no longer so-and-so's mother? And, you know, and at one point in your life, you might not be. You might be so-and-so's widow. Who are you going to be? Who are you? And I think that a lot of women forget that you could be everything to everybody. You could be a wonderful supportive spouse, and you could be a wonderfully nurturing mother. But you have to have an identity. And if you don't, that's where you see this pivotal down spiraling of identity, which eventually becomes costly.
I agree. And I have to say, my daughter is going to be 25 this month. On the 16th, she's turning 25.
Oh,
and,
God
bless. I know. Mm-hmm. She is fiercely independent. She said to me when she was going to college, she's a very artistic type, not an academic type. And she said, I'm going to school in San Francisco. And I said, Chelsea, you know, that's really expensive, and you could go to Rutgers for a fraction of that. She said, I have made up my mind. I want to go to an art school there. I don't need all these academic classes. I will probably just cut them anyway. It'll be a waste of your money, and I want to go there. So I remember dropping her off at, you know, we dropped her off at, in San Francisco, and it was the weirdest thing because your child that has lived with you all her life is now going to be dropped off in this gorgeous, gorgeous dorm that was where Jimmy, her room was where Jimi Hendrix slept. And, and so she had this, she had this old Commodore Hotel in downtown San Francisco, was bought up by the school, and it was where all the rock stars used to stay. And so Chelsea had Jimi Hendrix's room, and it was the coolest dorm I've ever seen. And we drop her off there, and then it's time to leave. And I'm like, my daughter is in a strange city that she's never been in before. And 2 days later, she said, well, she said, I figured out the whole bus line and how to get to my classes, and I just got two jobs. 2 days later.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, if I've ever done anything I'm more proud of in my life, it was she's it, because I raised an independent woman who was self-sufficient, who got herself two jobs the first 2 days in San Francisco, found her way on the bus line, figured out how to get to her classes in 2 days. That's success.
That
you
is.
Know, I,
that
this
really
kid
is.
Can take care of herself. She's gonna be just fine.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, I think most women should be raised to have a partner, but don't live your life around that partner. A partner should be supportive and, you know, embracing. But, you know, sometimes and eventually we walk the road on our own. And we have to keep that in mind. Who we are is pivotal to the rest of our lives.
I got a lot of slack for this band, you know, initially. The time it took away from me being home. Oh, gosh. I mean, just the fact that I wasn't home like I always was, 24/7. You know, there were some things that were, you know, kind of not being done as often as they used to be. Some nights I had a show and I'd be coming home very late, as you know how shows go. And I just said, you know, nobody is going to tell me I cannot do this, because I took care of everybody for 12 years. And I still will look after people as part of my that's part of my commitment to a family. However, I was not going to be told, you can't do this. And I knew, knew in my gut that eventually you either have to accept or everybody is going to, their lives are going to change. And if I hold my ground and I refuse, if I dig my heels in and I refuse to not pursue what was important to me, I knew that if anybody really loved me, they were going to finally accept it. And thank God, my daughter ended up a music production major in college and created
you were a wonderful influence.
She had a piano. She taught herself guitar, piano. Well, she didn't teach herself guitar completely. She had some really, really good lessons from somebody I worked with as a collaborative with poetry and Tommy Boozum, and I'll say his name. But she grew up with arts, music, sport, everything. And you know, she was allowed to decide herself what she wanted to do. And so I'm, you know, I think as a mother or as a woman, period, you have an obligation to yourself to also be happy, because you could only bring to people what you are. And if you're miserable, if you're resenting people because all you do all day long is take care of them and nobody's looking after you, I'm sorry, but you have an obligation to make yourself at least reasonably happy so that what you feel inside you can bring to those you love. If you're miserable, you're not bringing much to the people you love.
You know what? Born in 1962, and I was raised with the diet pills of the 60s. And women who were home, they just wanted to look a certain way. They had, and it was just this horrible, horrible existence and dynamic between women and their children. And again, women probably didn't realize they resented being home because they didn't, you know, it was Mr. and Mrs. Cleaver. You didn't realize that you knew instinctively that there was something more that you wanted, but you were in a house and you were making a meal and you were cleaning the rooms and that was all your existence was. And your husband came in and he was the one who, you know, laid down the law. And I think that women need to see that you could have an infusion of talent, philosophy that is the same level as your husband, whether or not he makes more of an income than you. You value. And I think that a lot of women, especially women of the 60s and the 70s, you just didn't get that. And when you think about, look at what you were doing. If John Bon Jovi was doing the same thing you were, and he did, he was never questioned because, you know, he's a guy. God bless him. He's a mover and a shaker. But women are not. They're poor parents. So what about, and I'm sure he's a wonderful person. I'm not speaking ill of him. But he wasn't there for a lot of his family's life. So he's not going to be judged as a bad father, but you would be judged as a bad mother. Why does that make sense? It doesn't.
Yeah. I grew up with a mother. My parents divorced when I was 3 and a half, and or maybe 4. And so I don't remember much before that. I have some memories back about 3. I don't really remember much before 3, but my mother had to be a working mother. She was a single mother. And so my memory of growing up was I walked myself the mile to school. Then I came home a mile on my lunch break. I made myself lunch. After Bewitched and Underdog were over, I'll never forget that. You watched Bewitched and then you watched Underdog. And then you walked back to school. And you walked back to school. And then you went to the rest of the day of school. And then you came home and you made a TV dinner.
Yeah.
And that's what you did.
Yeah.
You know, so I was used to, you know, having to take care of myself. And I was used to my mother working as long as she had to work because she was a hairdresser. And so whenever she had appointments, she wasn't working until they were done. And, but I know when I was sick, and this is one of my favorite things, when I was sick and I had to stay home from school, my mother would take me with her to work and she'd put me in the wig room. Now, I don't know if you remember the little old lady salons with the helmets for dryers.
Yes.
She used to put me in the wig room, and she knew she could just leave me alone in there, and I would entertain myself. And each you know, head with a wig on it had a name, so there was like Gladys and Edith and Dolores, and they would make them gossip and talk to each other. And my mother told me later that they used to come up to the door and listen in because it was hysterical. Like Gladys would say to Edith,
sweet.
Like, you would never believe what happened the other day. My kids aggravated me so much, but I would use curlers and set the wigs and put them under the dryer, and she could leave me for hours like that. And I was the easiest kid, she said, because anywhere she went, it didn't matter if I had other kids to play with or not. I entertained myself the entire time.
Which was going to lead me to my next point about art as escapism. You know, again, I know so many talented people that just, you know, just delve into a different mindset that's away from their lifestyle. And there are just, I think everybody has, I don't want to say, I don't like the word talent. I think that everybody's special in their own way. But circumstances push you to look and, you know, pull a layer apart and see what you're made of. And that sounds a lot like, you know, your lifestyle forced you into looking into different branches of yourself, which I think in the end, and for your children too, is just a wonderful gift.
I don't think I would be alive if it wasn't for escapism. Because I was removed from my home when I was a kid. It's a long story. I left my mother's. I went to my father's. The school took me out. It's a story I don't want to really say on radio. I got into, at a very young age, I got into a lot of drugs and things like that. And I found a teacher in my high school, the theater arts teacher, just took a liking to me and thought I would be good for his theater class in theater. Mm-hmm. And also gymnastics was a discipline. So when I got into gymnastics, my coach became like a father figure, and I wanted to please him. So I was, you know, very disciplined.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found theater, my theater arts class, and also a teacher, a creative writing teacher. Those two teachers saw something in me that, and they gave me their time. Mm-hmm. And that kind of changed the game for me. And that's when I decided that I wanted to write and be an actress. And so at 17, I went to see Lee Strasberg in New York, the Lee Strasberg Theater Institute. And
perfect.
So, you know, that's when I realized that, wow, you can actually channel your anger and your pain. And stereotypically, all those things a lot of people go into the arts for. I just found it a good way to get out of my own head. And for brief moments, you could be somebody else until I learned method technique. And then the irony is that method technique is about tapping into yourself and learning how to be able to channel all that stuff within yourself to portray a character, but at the same time being in control of it, because you can't go and have a nervous breakdown on stage. You have to be whatever it is you're tapping into. And so I think that art saved me, because if I didn't have it, if I didn't have poetry and theater and dance, I don't know that I would be able to get everything out that I was feeling.
You know, that's amazing, because you think of method acting, you think of Marlon Brando, you think of all the people that came out of that theater. And again, that you look at them, and they, if you look at their Wikipedia, they had, you know, a fragmented home life. And, you know, you think about these people that brought great art into our lives because of something that they were lacking that they were able to tap into and, you know, make a wonderful tapestry out of.
It goes one of two ways, you know. Again, I always say that I am a person that tries to look for the beauty in something. Nobody escapes this life without pain. Nobody escapes this life without, loss. And so you have to also say that, okay, well, if I had never felt these things, I also would never know love. I also would never know the kindness of somebody. And you take those things and you just, you if you don't focus that way, you're going to be somebody who dies of a heroin overdose, or you're going to be somebody that just can't shake an addiction, or that ends up in a psychiatric unit, because you have to find the grace and the beauty and the humbleness in life.
Because there is. You know, again, I tell people, whatever is happening bad, there's the wonderful things to balance it. And when you think about, we're all passing through. This is really it. We're all just passing through here. So just accumulate the best of the best and just focus on that. Because, you know, I always say, when I was a kid, I used to think of, I was raised Roman Catholic, and I remember my mother telling me about heaven, hell, and purgatory. And I remember at 8, I asked her, how do we know this is not purgatory? And she looked at me. And she said, what are you talking about? I said, but there's a balance of good and bad. There's ugly and there's beautiful. So how do we know that this is not just purgatory? And I remember for the first time in my mother's life, she could not answer me. So
that's so funny, because I used to say the same thing. I still do.
Really?
But I was raised with no religion, okay? The only thing I knew about
God
was, well, my mother was one of five girls, and her mother died when she was only like 15. So my mother was pretty much on her own at that point. But the thing is that my mother used to say to me all the time, you don't do this, or you, if you talk back to me again, God is going to punish you. Remember the God that punished you? So, God was always going to punish you. So my view of this God, you know, other than I didn't have really religion, but my view of this God was, God is so freaking mean, you know. God is always going to punish people. And so... So one day my mother said something like, God help us. I said, Mom, God's not going to help you, because all he does, he just punishes people. And my mother looked at me and she goes, why did you say that? I said, because the only thing you've ever talked about God is he's going to punish me. And she goes, okay. And she never said it again after that.
Yeah. that made her, that gave her pause for thought, of course. Yeah.
I mean, I remember my mother, was great at trying to salvage moments with me. But I remember I was about 7 years old and I was in the playground of my apartment and some boy grabbed me off the swing and kissed me. And then and threw me on the ground.
How old were you?
I was 7
how
when
old
this happened.
Then?
How
you
old
both
am
then,
I?
Yeah. Okay.
How old were you then?
7?
7.
Yeah.
7. And so I ran home to my mother was putting her makeup on in the bathroom mirror and I was sitting on the toilet and I said, Mom, how do you get pregnant? Like how do you get a baby in your belly? And she said, she goes, when God decides it's time for you to have a baby, the man and the women, they kiss. And I started freaking out. I got hysterical and I thought for sure I had a baby in my belly.
So my mother's relationship
with God was really like an excuse on how to get out of things with her kids.
But you poor thing, you must have been so confused at 7.
Oh yeah, I thought for sure I was going to have a baby, and I was like, yeah, I don't want one of those. I want to play outside on the swing.
You know, it's funny, but it's not, because you must have had a couple of restless nights thinking about, my God, what's going to happen here?
Oh, I was like, I'm going to get, big, and she's going to know, and I'm going to have this belly, and what am I going to do?
You poor thing.
But, you know, it's funny.
Oh, you poor
thing. One of the things that I had decided because of that I was going to tell my daughter at about 11 years old, I was going to make sure she understood everything, you know, the way you're supposed to. Understand
sure.
it. I wasn't going to get into the details, but I was going to make sure she understood. And I remember sitting her down and saying, okay, Chelsea, I need to have this talk with you about about the birds and the beach. She goes, Mom, really?
Sure.
She goes, really?
Oh,
you all already know about this stuff, Mom. And I'm like, wow, the world's really changed. I mean, these kids, 11 years old, they already kind of get it, you know?
Listen, I remember, God rest my mother, I miss her every day, but when it came time to talking to me, she threw a pamphlet in front of me that said, your peer is your friend, and she ran out of the room, and I never saw her again. That was it. That was our talk. And I always say, I'm 58 years old. I'm still waiting for the talk. I never got it. It was just that pamphlet, your peer is your friend. Everything else
did you
was,
have,
you know,
did,
groping in the dark.
Grade, did they take you into the auditorium? Just the girls were asked to come out of the class?
Of course.
And the boys all would giggle?
Yes.
Because it was like, oh, the girls are going
ma'am.
To that movie. And then you had to
absolutely.
Sit in the auditorium and watch the movie.
Yes.
And we were just absolutely. mortified having to leave the classroom in front of the boys to go to this movie. They knew it was about that.
That's exactly
it's
right. And think about the humiliation in that. That was crazy. That was crazy.
There was no reason for that. When you think about what it's like growing up female in America.
Terrible.
And a boy will never understand this.
No,
it really
no.
is a weird experience to grow up female.
It is.
Especially in our America of you and probably, experienced a lot of similar things. And, you know, things just weren't talked about then. Like, your parents just hoped the school would handle it. And if you went to Catholic school, forget it. I mean, you just,
forget it. You got hit with
the found magazines
with a ruler
or whatever.
Your
to learn whatever
absolutely.
You had to learn.
Absolutely. But think about this, as bad as it was for us, and it was, think about the little boys that were taught that you have to be able to fight, you have to be a man, you can't do this, you can't like cooking, you can't like anything autistic. You got to be a man. And boys don't cry.
I knew this from dancing, boys in dance school, they were so made fun of. And also you couldn't cry if you were a boy.
Terrible.
And I think that was the most destructive thing that was ever done to any human beings is to tell them you can't cry.
Absolutely. And this is what I'm saying. It was bad for us. But think about a guy that grows up that has to be able to defend his woman, do this, do that, make sure that all the bills are paid. That's a lot, and it's not fair. And not to be able to cry, not to be able to feel maternal or paternal, that's a horrible thing to impact on a little boy.
So, well, I grew up with a father like that, so I know what the result of that is, and it is never a good result.
No. You know, it's funny. I had a show that I did years ago about if we want men to respect women, we have to raise our little boys to respect little girls. And I had this one call in that said she had a little boy, and she was my age. She was born in 62, and she had her son, and he always wanted to play with dolls. And she fought with the husband, but she allowed him to play with dolls. And she said he is a wonderful father and a wonderful husband because he was able to develop his skills of nurturing. And she said, I got flack from my friends there, but you know what? It was the best thing I could have done for him. So there you go.
Sure. I am of the Montessori mind that you should allow children to gravitate to what they are. They will
Absolutely.
Always tell you who they are. And if you allow a child, if you work, I know what I'm trying. The point I'm trying to make is, I remember when Chelsea was a little girl, and I was going to the gym,
mm-hmm.
and they had a daycare there, and one of the fathers mm-hmm. of one of the children there, one time said to me, I was really upset because she had a meltdown and she was screaming, and I was
mm-hmm.
just all flustered.
Mm-hmm.
And Chelsea was a very strong-willed kid from the get-go, even
mm-hmm.
as a baby,
mm-hmm.
like she just wants what she wants, and that, you know, and this man said to me, he said, you know, I watched you many times coming and going here at the gym,
mm-hmm.
and he said, and I've watched your child. He said, I am a child psychologist,
mm-hmm.
and I said, hello, how are you?
Uh-huh.
Blah, blah, blah. And he said,
uh-huh.
if I can ever tell you one bit of advice that will help you for the rest of your life as with her, and that would be that your child will tell you who they are and just work within that.
Beautiful.
And that,
yeah.
I realized that Chelsea needed a sense
mm-hmm.
of control. But
mm-hmm.
I also did.
Yeah.
So we often battled, but she had to do what made her, like, I remember because I did gymnastics, so I started taking her to gymnastics. And pretty early on,
mm-hmm.
I got that she just was never going to be, she wasn't that into it. So I said to her one day, do you like coming here? She goes, not really. I said, fine. You don't have to go anymore.
Yeah.
And then her dad's really into soccer, and he started taking her to soccer. And, you know, she wasn't all that into that either. And she liked music, and she liked theater, and she liked instruments. And so a friend gave her her first guitar for Christmas one year. And she didn't touch it that year, but she picked it up a couple years later, and she taught herself how to play. And I went, oh.
Nice.
Okay.
Wow. That's cool. Yeah.
And she just taught herself the man. Then it was the piano. Then it was mandolin. Then she just taught
mm-hmm.
herself how to do keyboards, everything. She just had this natural affinity to music. And so I let her run with it.
And that's a beautiful thing. And obviously she got that from you. You know, she got that from your creative process.
Well, I could never play an instrument, and I know I've had this argument with so many people that say, oh, you could. I could sit you down and teach you. Henry one time sat me down and tried to show me notes on a guitar, and it was like somebody put a bowl of spaghetti in front of me and said, make music out of that. They're just – my brain doesn't operate that way. I literally would not remember one second later what you just showed me. And I knew. And it was frustrating because I literally – don't have the focus to be able to sit there and be taught. So, but I know that as a dancer, it's like you said, your husband's a drummer. When I was in school, I took drums and I was really good. I was really, really good at rhythm and percussion. And the boys didn't like me. I was the only girl in the drum lessons. And then when it came to marching parades, you know, they'd give me the big drum to bang. Nobody would let me play the drum, the snare. And so I quit because they really abused me. They really, really were mean to me. And I dreaded going to class.
That's horrible.
That now. But I would have been really good at a percussion instrument. I've got good rhythm. But please,
and you know,
don't
something,
ever.
It's not too late. It's not too late. It's never too late.
Well, it isn't too late, but I don't have the interest now because I like being up front and being able to dance and move. I love physically expressing stuff with my body. It's like you said, it's a form of escapism. So when I get up on stage, I could roll and grind and stomp my foot and get all this stuff out of me that if I were to do that in real life walking down the street, they'd put me in an asylum. But on stage, you could get that all out. You could scream and you can get your, I always call it getting your yayas out. And something you could do on stage that you could never do anywhere else. So I enjoy that. I don't want anything in my hand to play. I don't want to be encumbered by it. I want to be able to move freely physically.
I hear you. And you know what? I'm getting the producer in my head. And 10 seconds, and I knew this was going to happen between us. Cindy Dawson, you have to come on the show again for a two-hour show because this dialogue could go forever. We thank you. We're going to be going off the air in 5 seconds. Thank you.
Love
all your information is going to be on my Facebook page tomorrow. Love you, sweetheart. Thank you so much
you
for
soon.
Joining us. Talk to you soon, darling.
Bye-bye.